You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Well,
Ezekiel saw the wheel of rolling, the great big wheel of turning over. Ezekiel saw the wheel of rolling, way in the middle of the air.
Oh, thank God.
Ezekiel saw the wheel of rolling, the great big wheel of turning over. Ezekiel saw the wheel of rolling, way in the middle of the air.
Well, great God Almighty, bright and clear, Ezekiel saw the wheel in the middle of the air. Great big wheel and a little bit of wheel, a wheel turning over in the middle of the wheel. The good book says, and the book don't lie, God told Ezekiel to prophesy. Then my God spoke in Ezekiel's mind, he raised his voice and began to cry. He cried, old bones,
old songs are walking.
Great God Almighty, the old bones are talking.
Old bones, bones, won't you hear me now? Old bones,
you hear the word of God.
Ezekiel's song, the wheel of rolling, the great big wheel of turning over. Ezekiel saw the wheel of rolling, way in the middle of the air.
Great God.
Ezekiel saw the wheel of rolling, the great big wheel of turning over. Ezekiel saw the wheel of rolling, way in the middle of the air.
Well, God told Ezekiel to prophesy. Zeke tried to do it, and that's no lie. God sent the wind from the west and the east. Spirit struck him from his head to his feet. He cried, old bones,
old bones are walking.
Great God Almighty, the old bones are talking.
Old bones, bones, won't you hear me now? Old bones,
hear the word of God.
Ezekiel saw the wheel of rolling, the great big wheel of turning over. Ezekiel saw the wheel of rolling, way in the middle of the air.
Well, old Ezekiel tried his best to do the Lord had told him to.
He did his best, that's all he can.
After all, Zeke was a natural man.
Ezekiel saw the wheel of rolling, the great big wheel of turning over. Ezekiel saw the wheel of rolling, way in the middle of the air.
One more,
Ezekiel
one more.
Ezekiel saw the wheel of rolling,
Zeke.
The great big wheel of turning over.
My man,
Zeke. Ezekiel saw the wheel of
rolling,
way in the middle of the air.
Yes, indeed, oh. Zeke was wailing that time.
Ashe.
Ashe.
We'll pour to the creative spirit, the great Ashe out of which we all emerge. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to that creative spirit by whatever name we know it, whatever name you hold in your heart, in your mind, whatever name your ancestors gave, whatever name you learned as a child, whatever name you believe it to be, whatever name you believe it to be in spirit or in science. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to the first human beings who came into existence on this planet, the first human beings who raised the first structures, who cooked the first meals, who taught the first children, who had the first children, the first Africans, the first people who stood upright, who walked, who figured out how to stay on this planet, who figured out how to pass that knowledge on to their children and their children's children, the mothers and fathers of civilization. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour the next libation to their grandchildren, their children's children, those who raised the great early civilizations of Kemet and Kush and Monomotapa, the great medieval civilizations of Ghana and Mali and Songhai and Kanem-Bornu. We pour to those who great the great civilizations of the Igbo people and the Hausa people and the Kikongo people and the Mbara people, the great Mande civilizations, the great Kikongo, the great civilizations of Southern Africa, the Bantu people, the great civilizations of Southeast Africa, the Dinka, the Shilluk, the Noor. We pour to those millions who raised the foundations from which the world would learn what it meant to be human in the world. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who, upon the arrival on the shores of people they had never seen before, found themselves captured and marched overland, found themselves perishing by the millions before they were held on the holding cells and the open air pens on the coast of West, Central, Southern, and East Africa. We pour to the ancestors who did not know as they were stripped of all clothing and sent denuded into boats, packed like animals and strewn their bones across the floor of the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean. We pour to them who in the last moment on Africa grabbed the sand and grabbed the dirt and put it in their mouths and understood that the only thing they might have to preserve their place in that continent was their memory of that place and their ability to pass it on to their children. We pour to them. Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to those Africans and their children who finding themselves cast adrift in Santiago, Cuba, who found themselves cast adrift in Puerto Spain, Trinidad, and Port-au-Prince, Haiti, who found themselves cast adrift in New Orleans and Charleston and Mobile, who found themselves cast adrift in Salvador, Bahia, who found themselves cast adrift in Barbados and the archipelago that formed the Wayward and the Windward Coast. We found them in these places learning Portuguese and Spanish and French, whose often first words was, "Oh my God," or "Madre de Dios," who found themselves praying to survive and pass on to their children the memories. We pour to those ancestors who are represented in the thousands buried in all the square miles of where we stand and who sit here buried before us in 400 caskets forged of wood from West Africa with Adinkra symbols. Each one of them, each woman, man, and child, symbolic of millions. The children of those who could not be killed, we pour, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who somehow survived the hells of enslavement and fought for emancipation in the Caribbean, the French, British, Dutch Caribbean, who fought for emancipation in South America, who fought for emancipation in Central America, who fought the struggles we refer to as the Civil War in the United States, who came out of that, marched out of enslavement through Reconstruction, and found themselves making great migrations, eventually ending up in places like New York. Their children's children, who making a way for themselves, became our great-great-grandparents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents, our parents. Those who, when the first bones were discovered in this space, held their hands and said, "Stop! No more! We are here to speak for those who can no longer speak with their mouths." We pour for those ancestors, some of whom came to Howard University in 2004 and followed these caskets all the way back to New York. We pray to the great ancestors, the ones whose names we know and the ones whose names we don't. And at this moment, as we pour this libation, I would ask anyone who feels comfortable to say the name of someone in your bloodline who is no longer physically here, but who you know made it possible for you to be here. Go ahead, let's hear the names.
Haywood Carr.
Porter Griffin.
Thomas Jr.
Evelyn Glover.
We pour to the names that we hold collectively. Ganga Zumba in Brazil. Toussaint Louverture, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, and Henri Christophe in Haiti. We pour to the great Avengers, Nanny of the Maroons of Jamaica. We pour to the great ancestors, Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, Frederick Douglass. Say the names that you study. Who are the names of the ancestors that you have come to hold in your heart and your mind as you hope that you can do what they did for us, for your children and children's children? Let's say some of those famous names.
Malcolm X, Honorable Elijah Muhammad,
John Henry Clark, John
Dr. Khaled
Jackson,
Muhammad,
Jacob Carruthers. And finally, two final libations. We pour to those who make it possible for us to do what we do. We pour to these rangers who stand guardian over this sacred space. We pour to these Africans and these folks who have come from Howard University, the staff, the faculty, the administrators who brought us here today to bear witness. This is not a libation, but an affirmation, because their hearts still beat, their tongues still speak, their minds still think, and their minds still wish the best for us. We pour for all of those people who surrounded us on this journey today and made it possible for us to be here. We pour this affirmation of thanks, Ashe.
Ashe.
And finally, we pour to your children's children's children who will one day stand on this space and speak your name. Ashe.
Ashe.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
It's a very serious subject, and so naturally my response has to be a very serious response. There are those who speak of police review boards, and there are many police review boards throughout North America. There are many police review boards that allegedly are set up to monitor the activity of the policing agencies. And certainly some good has come out of police review boards, but I do not believe that police review boards can deal with the high level of police brutality in the black community. Of all our studies, history is best qualified to reward our research. If we know what happened yesterday, then we can intelligently discuss police brutality today, because today is built on yesterday, and tomorrow indeed is built on today. The very coming into being and existence of the white man. Not too many people want to say the white man anymore. Not too many people even say the words white man together. And very few from a rostrum or a podium or a TV talk show or anywhere who will straight up call the white man the devil in 1997. So let's get that straight before I even get started. The white man is not a devil, but the devil. He is wicked by nature. He's the number one murderer, the number one robber, the number one raper, the number one lyncher, the number one enslaver, the number one colonizer. He is the chief shedder of blood on the face of the planet Earth, and no one has come close even to equaling the shedding of blood of the white man. As I started to say, his very existence is owed to the shedding of blood of the black man and black woman. There would be no white race if it were not for the genetic engineering, the grafting, the birth control, and the special process by which the white man came into existence, which required, again, the very shedding of blood of the black man and black woman. And so the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad has taught us that the circumstances surrounding the origin of a thing into the world determines the very nature of that thing. It codes that thing. It marks that thing. And that thing cannot help but do according to its coded nature. And if it is your bloodshed, and it is, that brought the white man into existence, then it must be your and my bloodshed that will keep him in power and in control. And so white supremacy and global white domination and rabid racism that runs rampant throughout the face of the planet Earth is based on the murder of the black man and black woman, but black man first. The black man is public enemy number one. Public enemy number one. Oh, he does not spare the black woman. For the black woman is spotted and speckled with all of the shades of color, of the color spectrum. Number one, she is all of the colors because she is the original woman. And out of her comes the black, the brown, the red, the yellow. And yes, out of her comes the white. But she is spotted and speckled today in another sense, because of the rape of our great-great-grandmothers and our great-great-great-grandmothers. I'm not going to get into that. Hell, all of them were great. Straight on down the line. The raping of the black woman. So she has not been spared. But again, I say, public enemy number one is the black man.
Good afternoon to all of you. Good evening. Welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank. We are so happy to hear you. We had a promotional piece that was supposed to play, but something happened there. But nevertheless, we're so happy to have you here with us this evening. Thank you so much for listening. My name is William Rogers, and I am your host. We have a very dynamic and powerful subject that we want to talk about tonight. We want to kind of look at some of the events that have occurred in our nation over the last couple of weeks and try to understand that from an African perspective. Try to understand that in a way that we can move forward and not be tied up by a lot of the madness that we have seen. We have some guests that are going to be with us in very shortly, and they're going to join our conversation and talk with us about some things as well. One of the things that we're going to look at that's a little bit different is we're not going to look so much at the event. We're going to look at some of the causes. As I sat, like so many of you did, in your living rooms and chairs, and just sitting there and watching these men and women climbing the walls of the Capitol of supposedly the most powerful nation on the planet of the earth, was confusing, to say the least. Very difficult to explain how to tell a child that. And I remember my grandson was here with me. He's 6 years old. He asked me, "Grandpa, what are they doing? Where they going?" And my granddaughter was a little bit older. She's 9. She said, "That looked like that movie that we saw called World War Z." I said, "Yeah, you're right. They look like zombies climbing that wall." And so anyway, it needs to be discussed in the in our community, among our people, within our mindset. We need to understand that. So we need to move on. By no means are we at that type of behavior. Where does that behavior come from? It's nothing new. We've been doing this for a long, long time. And we just want to talk about that from a historical perspective. I am a historian by trade, and I always like to look at history. Like Malcolm said, it's the discipline that blessed rewards all about disciplines, and I do agree with that. And so that's what we're going to do tonight. We got some guests, as I said, that's going to join us, and we're going to talk a little bit about some specific events. But again, just answer the question, why? What is this? You know, why? Where did this come from? And how is it that we need to see? And what is it that we need to understand about what we see? As always, I like to do an ancestral profile. And the ancestral profile tonight, you know, as we usually like to do, sometimes we like to talk about individuals, but then sometimes we like to talk about events or either sometimes places. And tonight's ancestral profile is a place, and it has a very powerful impact on the history. It is based on a national historic landmark that was designated that back in October the 12th, 1994. It is located 2 miles north of St. Augustine, Florida, on the edge of a salt marsh on the western side of the waterway separating the mainland from the coastal barrier islands. The name of this location is Fort Mose, Florida. Fort Mose, and it's spelled like Moses, M-O-S-E, but it's pronounced Mose, Fort Mose of Florida. The original site of this 18th century fort was uncovered in 1986 archaeological dig. It is 24 acres site, and it is now being protected as a Florida State Park, administered through the Antasia State Recreation Area. Fort Mose is the premier site on the Florida Black Heritage Trail. In 1738, the Spanish governor of Florida, Manuel D. Martiano, had Fort Mose constructed and established it as a free black settlement. It is the first to be legally sanctioned in what would become the territory of the United States. The fort was also been called Fort Mose or Fort Mosa. It depends on the variation of the Spanish tongue and how it's pronounced. But as early as 1689, the colonial authorities of Spanish Florida had begun to offer asylum to the escaped Africans fleeing from the Virginia colonies. In 1693, King Charles II of Spain issued a royal decree proclaiming that runaways would be granted asylum in Florida in return for converting to Catholicism, which required baptism with Christian names and serving for 4 years in the colonial militia. By 1742, the community had grown into a maroon settlement similar to those in other European colonies in the Americas, and the Spanish utilized the settlement as the first line of defense against inside incursions into Florida. In 1738, Governor Montiano ordered the construction, as I said, of this fort. But actually, it was a safe haven for Africans who were being chased by the slave traders coming out of the Carolinas and out of Georgia. And they were able to escape into Florida and be safely placed there, because the British had not been able to go into Florida yet, because the Spanish still controlled it. The name Fort Mose was based on a military leader who was at the fort, who was an African. As I said, this was near St. Augustine. He was Mandinga, and he was born in the Gambia region of Africa, and he was baptized at Francisco Mendenez. He had been captured by slave traders and shipped across the Atlantic to the colony of the Carolinas, from where he, like many other enslaved persons, escaped and sought refuge in Spanish Florida. His status as a leader was solidified with the Spanish colonial authorities when he helped defend the city from a British attack by John Palmer. Fort Mose was the first free African settlement legally sanctioned in what would become the United States, and it had a population of about 100. The village had a wall around it with dwellings inside, as well as a church, an easement, and earthen fort. Hundreds of thousands of enslaved Africans were imported in the 18th century to the Carolinas, where their labor was essential to the plantation economy. Word of the settlement of the free blacks at Mose reached the colonies of South Carolina and Georgia and attracted the escaping Africans. Fellow blacks and their Indian allies helped the runaways flee southward to Florida. The Spanish colony needed skilled laborers, and the freedmen strengthened St. Augustine's military forces. In 1738, the Spanish governor established the runaways in their own fortified town, known as Gracia, Spanish, Real de Santa, long name, Teresa de Mose, but usually referred to simply as Mose, Fort Mose, in governmental documents of that period. The administrative action followed the examples of colonial governments in the Caribbean, enabling the Spanish to hold and populate territory threatened by the Carolinians. The existence of Fort Mose is believed to have helped inspire the Stono Rebellion in September of 1739. And this was led by enslaved Africans who were fresh from Africa. And during that Stono Revolt, they rapidly adjusted to life there, and they were already baptized Catholics. Many were from the Congo, and they spoke Portuguese. So, established in 1738, Fort Mose was the first free black settlement in what is now the United States. As I said before, it is located just north of St. Augustine, Florida. Fort Mose played an important role in the development of colonial North America. So I thought that would be interesting as we look at what some of the things that we are dealing with today and some of the things that we are facing. And I wanted you to just pass that on to all of you. and think about it. Take a look at it. There's a book written on Fort Mose you might find to be very interesting. Okay, so tonight we are going to look at this white psychosis that we are seeing in America and that we've been seeing for a long time. This just didn't start, as I indicated earlier. This has been going on ever since the colony that was developed in the 1600s. The thing that I think is necessary that helps us understand the idea of this is that American colony is British, obviously. It's a British colony. It belongs to the British people, the Anglos, the Saxons, the Normans, and some of those, the French are also a part of it. And most of Europe, as you know, is a German nation, most of that. The Franks, the Normans, the Anglos, Saxons, the Vandals, those are all German ethnicities. And these are the ones that were a part of the building of this particular colony that we called America. So they brought with them that attitude and that culture. And what they brought was an attitude and a culture that was nothing but shaken by pure war. Europe was a war colony. It was a place that saw war every day of their lives. They fought 100-year wars, 30-year wars. They fought continuously. And so there was a war nature to the European colonies that were being developed. And those were the ones. And that's what we are looking at. When you look at America, you're looking at the English. You're looking at the Germans and some of those other cultures that came. Even the Spanish is a Vandal culture, which is a German culture as well. The Portuguese, the Visigoths, the Ostrogoths, and all. And so the development culturally here is still a part of that. And they were shrouded in war. And the English were also unique to all of this. Their system of development had a lot to do with Scottish bloodline. And again, this is a kind of a history that you'd have to get into a little bit longer, but I just want to give you remnants of it. The Scottish were involved, and a lot of the Scots are basically those ones who would settle in the southern part of the United States. The Scots are the ones that their culture we would find being shrouded into the KKK and organizations like that. That's Scottish ideology, Scottish theory. And so those are the ones that are part of that as well. And the warlike nature that they endured in Europe and eventually would transfer over here never stopped. Even when they landed in Plymouth Rock in the 1600s, they landed in a warlike state. This country was populated thoroughly with people. We've often been told that it was these were a few scattered tribes and they were uncivilized and so forth and so on. And I know by now we all know that's not true. But the native people that were here were living a very successful life and had been done so all for a long time. But when those ships landed on Plymouth Rock, Jamestown, Virginia, and other places along the eastern coast of the United States, they came in a warlike state, even though they were religious. They were pilgrims, a lot of them, Quakers. These were all religious dissidents who were leaving Europe to come here, but they were coming here in a warlike mind. And so as eventually they would come, number one, to take the land and conquer it, and they would create a system to ensure that the land would be theirs. One of the first documents that was created when they landed in America was something called the Mayflower Compact. The Mayflower Compact was an agreement made by the Pilgrims when they landed. Oh, at first they were coming to Jamestown and got thrown off track and ended up in the northern part, which is Plymouth Rock, which we now call today is the New England area. But they would create this pact that established their ownership and leadership of this land, and not in agreement with necessarily the native people that lived here. The native people would fight them back there. They would attempt to first live with them. But then they would eventually have to realize that they would have to fight them because they did not come to be peaceful and they did not come to be friends. They came to take and pilgrimage. And we've heard all the stories, the Thanksgiving stuff, John Smith, Pocahontas. We heard all those mythologies that very clearly are not what we're looking at. So this is the settling of the United, what will become eventually the United States of America. And as you go through those centuries and look at their development, from the Mayflower Compact to the Articles of Confederation, to the U.S. Constitution, and some of the things that you would see in there are all designed to dominate, control, and run everything that's possible on that land. And then when we go back and we look at some of the historical events, we can actually see events like we saw in the last 3 days. There was one particular one that I've often looked at that occurred back around the 1700s, around 1787, right before the ratification of the U.S. Constitution. And that's something called Shays Rebellion. Shays Rebellion was a series of violent protests that was staged in 1786 and 1787 by a group of American farmers, poor working farmers, who objected to the way that the state and the local tax collection were being enforced. And while skirmishes broke out with New Hampshire to the South Carolina, the most serious acts of the rebellion occurred in rural Massachusetts. And that's when the farmers, led by a war veteran, and as you see, most of the people who lead these rebellions are soldiers. They have fought in wars. And this particular one, Daniel Shea, fought in the American Revolution. And he took up arms against the Massachusetts State Militia and the others in an attempt to overthrow the government. So Slave Rebellion was a series of armed protests staged in 1786 by these farmers. The farmers were angry because Massachusetts property taxes and penalties were killing them. Eventually, Shays Rebellion was put down in January 25th, 1787, when Massachusetts governor pulled together a small militia, which today we call the National Guard. And Shays Rebellion proved a couple of things. It proved, first of all, that the body of laws that they were living under, which were the Articles of Confederation, were weak, and there was going to be a need to do the U.S. Constitution. But here's the key factor that I found to be most interesting about what Shays Rebellion said that we can connect to what we just saw a couple of days ago is this. Thomas Jefferson sent a letter to the governor of Massachusetts, and in the letter, he argued. And he said to the governor, "Governor, don't let this bother you." He said, "This is actually good." He said, "An occasional rebellion is an essential part of liberty." He said, "The tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. And it's a natural manure." I'm going to repeat that. Jefferson again said that. He told the governor of Massachusetts, he said, "A rebellion is good. It's a good thing. Because we need to be able to refresh, the whole tenets of liberty." He said, "Cause the tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants. It is a natural manure." And that particular spirit is the spirit that we saw over the last couple of weeks. It also, there was also another letter that was written, and this was written by a woman, and she wrote and said that it was also a good thing, that let's not worry about this. It taught us that we need to strengthen our militia, our National Guard. We need to be able to be more alert and be on time for, you know, any other uprising, because there are going to be more, and we know this. And as a result, there were. There were many more that followed during that period of time. Well, this behavior has been written about over the years by many people. There is a dynamic study, and they've been written both by Europeans as well as others. Most of the writings come from Europeans who talk about this as a form of psychosis. And psychosis is not necessarily, I think the fact, I'm not a psychologist, but those who may be understand that it's not necessarily the sickness itself, but it's what causes it. It's the lack, it's from frustration, it's from things that happen, and you begin to see things that's not real. You operate out of reality. And as we've watched the man that's supposedly the president of this country, he has not been operating within reality. And that's the psychosis that many white males possess when they don't have their way. Because they feel, first of all, they're superior, which is also a part of their psychosis, that they are better than anybody else, that they are more entitled to things than anybody else. And as a result of that, they have a right to defend that, you know, over anybody else. I have a right to climb these walls. He said, one of those protesters said he had a right to go in and sit in Nancy Pelosi's chair. That's his chair. He lent it to her. And that's an entitlement that does not fit into reality. Police officers, in some cases, and what we've seen in a lot of the killings in the streets of America, of our men, of our brothers. These are men sometimes who feel that they're entitled to do that. This is their job. They're supposed to kill you. You know, you don't do what I say. You don't sit down. You disobeying me. It's kind of like a way a parent does with a child. You know, I got a right to whoop your butt. You know, you don't do what I tell you. I'm your daddy. I'm your mother. And that behavior runs rampant in America. There's an excellent paper that was written by Kay Andrews back in 2016. It's called The Psychosis of Whiteness, The Celluloid Hallucination of Amazing Grace and Bell. And it talks about the whole idea of this critical whiteness studies and really what whiteness is. And whiteness is a psychosis that I am better, I am prettier, I am richer, I am more powerful. And once you have that embedded into your mind, you then can take liberties that we have been seeing for a long time. And they said, I can own you as a piece of property because I'm better than you. You are nothing. You're an animal. And this is the behavior that's being played out. And so the reason that we, as brothers, African brothers and sisters, have to discuss this is because, first of all, we're dealing with most of our brothers who are not operating in reality. And so we have to bring that reality home. And how we do it has to be organized within ourselves. We're going to have to be adamant about it, and we're going to have to be persistent. So this whole psychosis, as I said, is a psychological disorder. It's hallmarked by delusional thinking and hallucinations. Now, these are psychologists and psychiatrists saying this. European psychologists and psychiatrists are saying this. This is not William Rogers. And they're describing the delusion at the heart of psychosis as being false beliefs that the person or the patient maintains in the face of overwhelming contradictory evidence. These delusions give rise to hallucinations, which are believed as real to maintain that psychosis. The metaphor of psychosis is advanced as the perfect way to understand how whiteness is produced and maintained. This article argues that the big budget films present as historical hallucinations to support the distorted view of reality produced by whiteness. So when we see this Hollywood is the best at that. When we see these movies, when we see even the way 12 Years a Slave was portrayed, we see that hallucination. We see white men fascinated over black women's bodies and that hallucination that they take on in that whole idea. And it seems that the British have been the hardest at this more than anybody else. And as you go in, and we obviously tonight we don't have time to study this, go through this whole particular study, but these critical whiteness studies really opens your eyes to understand why white people respond and act in the way that they do. Even during the years of the civil rights movement and how they operated, they always had to get in it to show that the great white father can save. We're the only ones that can save black people. Well, why is it that you feel you're the only one can save black people? Well, because we're better than they are. So Marlon Brando had to go over to the Edmund Pettus Bridge and some of the other white stars and walk them across, because they wouldn't have been able to walk across unless we would have been able to do that or been there with them. And we've heard our ancestors talk about that forever. And so, as I said, the central thesis of the whiteness studies is that whiteness is a psychosis. And that's what we are operating every day in the United States. Every day we are operating under that banner. And so what you saw climbing the walls of the White House was a whiteness psychosis that I'm better. And there have been tons of, as I said, books that have been written about this. There's another interesting book called How the Irish Became White. How the Irish Became White. Because that's a strange metaphor in terms of looking at how all of this worked. The Irish have always been persecuted by the British. Well, they've been persecuted by the British because they feel that the Irish have too much African blood in them. All of us have heard of the Celtic culture, and the Celtic culture is believed to have been very closely related to African. Tony Browder, in his book, talked about who the Celts were and what all of that meant. And these were Africans that had migrated up into the northern part of Europe, and they wore crowns with seven snakes on it. And they worshipped in fire. They worshipped round circles in fire. And as you know, all of Europeans are basically more linear. But the Celts were believed in the fire circle. And they were practicing strange religion. And the Catholic Church didn't like that. And they felt that they was doing a curse to the people. And so the Pope sent one of his soldiers up there, whose name was Patrick. And Patrick went up to that northern region and waged war on those Celtics. And he slaughtered them all. And the Pope made him a saint. His name is Saint Patrick. And today the Irish celebrate him in March as Saint Patrick's Day. But if you were to look at a symbol of St. Patrick, he's holding a sword in his hand, and that around his feet are snakes, which means that he slew the people who wore the crown of the seven snakes. And if you go back into commission culture, you know, that's all sacred symbols. And all of that is a part of this understanding that we are confronting now. But if you get in, for some of you who may be interested in this, I would ask you to, you could email me, and I would make sure that you get a copy of this study. Again, it's called The Psychosis of Whiteness. And it explains in detail, really detail, of what is it that we are seeing. And like I said, I don't have time to go through it tonight because of the fact that, you know, I want to give you all a chance to talk and discuss this as well. But I'll make sure you do that. One other thing I want to do before I open it up for the lines is talk about some of the material that's out there as well that you might be interested in. And I'll also make arrangements for some of you who might be interested in that as well, too, on how to get some of this material as well. I want to tell you about one particular one. This is what I found to be really, really, really interesting. This was a book written by a brother. And what he said, the article talked about the fact that the English, the Brits, were actually worse than the Nazis. Some of the things that we heard that the Nazis did, the British were triple that. And he documents that. He goes in to document what he means by that. He also says that the violent nature of white males is clearly backed by statistics. And there's no reason to understand, because it's just that the way the violence is handled, now. For instance, there's a claim that 69% of white men who run into trouble on different counts, only about 10% of that is reported. And what you get is black men who are much, much less than that. But at the same time, their numbers seem to be, and their prison numbers are higher than white males. He also said white men account for 69% of those arrested for violent crimes, but they don't always get convictions the way black men get. This is a psychosis. This is not real. These are judges who sit back and look at catalogs while you while trials are being heard. I remember once in New York seeing a judge looking at a boat book while they were while trial was being held to determine what to set bail on these two young brothers for selling narcotics. But he was reading the boat book, and he went through. So things like that. Those are, but that's behavior that is definitely linked to this psychosis that we're talking about. But there is, again, there's other readings too that all document what I'm saying. Like I said, this is not Bill Rogers talking. This is theoricians and doctors and folk that have studied this. But there is an excellent list of books that talk a little bit about what we are seeing now, and people have begun to have written about a lot of what we are seeing over the last 10, 15 years up to now. And there's a list of them, and obviously I can't go through all of them, but I just want to kind of look at a few of them. There's one called The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, by Naomi Klein. This is a book that was published in 2010, it seems. There's another book called Nickel and Dime on Not Getting By in America. These are books that also explain some of the political economic factors that we are encountering, and what a lot of times what the white mindset sees. Because you see, one of the things we saw over the week was a reflection to politics, but there's an economic picture to that too. And you have to think about it. This country possesses some of the most dynamic corporations in the world. There are corporations here that make trillions of dollars, and they're not going to let this be destroyed. So I don't think that we are looking at Armageddon. That's just not going to happen. This is going to fade out in the next couple of months or so, and we're going to go back to police shootings and locking up a whole lot of black folk and poverty and cutting off people's lights and evicting people out of houses. So this is not going to last. And you're going to see that white psychosis kick in very shortly. And that's going to be people with no mercy and so forth. Noam Chomsky, one of my favorite writers I like, has a book called Hegemony or Survival, America's Quest for Global Dominance. Talking about that, and that's another thing you have to think about when you're looking at what happened at the White House. You have to think about the global connection of that. You got people who are your enemies sitting around looking at folks climbing the walls, going into your building of legislative and executive power, sitting on the desk, breaking out windows. What kind of image is that? Something is behind that. I feel, at least that's my conviction. I'd be glad to hear your opinion about that. I don't think that this is all what we see is all we're getting. There's some more to this. And I'd like to hear your opinions as well. There's a book by Ray Bradbury called Fahrenheit 451. That's an old book. But it does. It's an interesting fiction piece that kind of talks about some other things. And then there's this book called American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America. That's a real interesting. A lot of this field is being generated by Christianity and the whole religious ideology of things. And don't forget, capitalism is built off of religion. There's a book written way back by Max Weber called Capitalism and the Protestant Ethic. And it talks about the connection between religion and capitalism and how all of that works. And then there's some old books in here that this is a particular person who's, it's a list of about 100 books that talks about all of that. And one of some of the old books like Candide by Voltaire, that does some things. All the President's Men gives you an inside look. And the one that I really think a lot of folks have to go back and look at again, The Godfather, Part 1, 2, and 3, about how America is run and how it does things. But I just wanted to mention that in terms of the literature that's out there and the literature that is available for us to look at. And like I said, don't take my word. It really is a lot more to that. And I wanted to just give you that brother, the brother's name that... that said, he said the British Empire did more damage than Nazis hits out at white psychosis. And he's also writing about white psychosis. His name is Kehinde Andrews. And his view is that whiteness is a psychosis after appearing on a program recently in Britain. And he goes into detail to talk about what his study was about. And it's an excellent book to do that. There's an article in Psychology Today called Why Are White Men So Violent? That also talks about some of the same things. And so it's not just me. It's not just us here. That's some truth behind it. You just don't talk about it. As Brother Khalid Muhammad said in the clip that I played for you, he said, people don't talk about that. You don't want to talk about white men. A lot of times you're scared to talk about that. But it has to be talked about when you see some of the things that you're seeing now. And there's another brother, his name is, he's a philosopher, but he's a brother, his name is Tommy Curry. He's done a lot of things on critical race theory and so forth. He has some excellent books that talks about it. But again, I'll give you my email, and you all can email me, and I can get some of that to you. Sankofa, all small letters, Sankofa, underscore, think, at outlook.com. Sankofa, S-A-N-K-O-F-A, underscore, think, at outlook.com. And what we can do, I can pass on some of this to you and let you take a look at some of this yourself. It's an interesting study, an interesting reading. To take a look at, and I think that you will definitely enjoy. So with that, I want to talk for just a minute before the top of the hour. Yeah, we got two or three minutes. We had a guest, 414-732.
Yes,
sir. How you doing? How you doing? How you doing, my brother?
How are you today?
Great, great. I wanted to just kind of briefly talk to you, and this is more of a personal question format, because these are just some things that I were looking at over the week, and just it has baffled my mind. My brother is a former police officer. He's retired. He is also was in the National Guard, what we called in the old days is the militia. So he has some kind of experience. Let me ask you, have you ever seen or heard anything like what happened last week in the overtaking of the house during your years as the National Guard?
Oh, sir, I've never seen anything like that. I never imagined anything like that.
Right.
If someone had told me that that was going to happen, I would have had problems believing that.
Right.
But in retrospect, when you look at what happened, I don't know if you guys remember, but a couple weeks ago, General Flynn, who Trump had just pardoned, suggested to Trump that he should bring in the military and redo the election. Mm. So when you look, take a real good look at what happened, you can tell that that was strategically planned, and I would suspect that General Flynn, along with Trump and probably some other higher up officials, had something to do with that situation. That just wasn't an action that was generated by the common man. I think that when all of this plays out, we're probably going to be surprised at how high this goes.
And the question I have is why? What did they hope to accomplish from it? I don't think they really thought that they could overturn the election. Do you think they were after something else? Were they trying to achieve another goal?
Well, you know, I think that when you look at how rabid Trump supporters are, it was just a display of mindless barbarity. And you
right.
were speaking earlier on the psychosis of the white man. And, you know, history bears this out. I mean, we haven't seen this in recent history, but we see that the white man is capable
yes.
of an evil that is just beyond our comprehension as black people. And it happens again and again and again, even when you look at slavery. And even though they don't teach it in history class, or they don't teach it in school, I mean, some of the things that they did, like using African children as bait for alligators and making belts and wallets out of the skin of black people,
yeah.
or coming into the bedroom of a black couple that had been recently married, and then they would take the black woman before the man even had the chance to be with her. I mean, these things are evidence of a depraved mind, and it hasn't changed. And then what happened at the White House, I mean, they actually urinated and defecated inside of the White House. What does that have to do with anything?
Yes,
I mean, it's just the sickness.
Yes, it is. It is very baffling for me. Very baffling. In terms of your police training, let's go there for just a minute. I know that Brother Horace Kraft, who hosts the Elders of Sankofa program, and he's done several events on police officers and some of the shootings that we've seen, and particularly that one in Kenosha. I've watched that clip over and over again. From your perspective, was there a problem with that brother walking to his car? Was that the way a police officer would have handled that? I mean, even if he felt that there was a weapon involved, is that the process? Is that the training method that you're taught to use if something like a situation like that occurs?
Well, you know, I'm so, because that situation with Jacob, who was shot in the back, I think six or seven times, and you have to think about who shot in the back.
Your phone is going out just a little bit. It's going in and out just a little bit.
Okay, I'm sorry. Let me see if I can change locations here.
Okay.
But they're alleging that he had a knife. He was shot in the back. When his back was to them, he was the least threat to them. you know, this deeply troubles me, that as well as some of these other violent incidents involving the police. And they always justify by saying that they thought that a black person was going to try to kill them. Well, I just recently checked the statistics. Annually, about 60 police officers are killed a year by citizens, but the police kill 1,000 people a year. So when you think of it that way, who should be concerned or who should be afraid or who should feel threatened by who? I mean, it's the police that are threatening black people. It's not the other way around.
Right.
And to answer your question, no, there was no reason to shoot that man in the back. It was three officers to one man. I mean, they could have stood in front of the car to keep him from getting in the car, or they could have just wrestled him to the ground. But, you know, they dehumanized him. They saw him as not worth life, not worth consideration, and they had no conscience at all, or the officer had no conscience at all about shooting him in the back. He was a human being.
Right.
And, you know, I would classify that officer as a coward for doing that, and I think that he should be in jail.
Right. I have a theory, and I'd like for you, if you could, just tell me how realistic is this theory. My theory is that somewhere back when Trump came into office and he was telling police officers about let's lock them up, let's get rid of them, so forth and so on, that I think that there were groups of people from that white group that came together and decided that they were going to support any officer who may get himself for shooting a black. They would pay for their legal fees, make sure that their families were taken care of, even if they had lost their jobs. And so to kind of just put the word out there that you're not going to lose. Just do what you got to do, and we'll back you up. And I even had this conversation with somebody who thinks maybe that it might have been real. But I just want to ask you, do you think that's possible? Hello, are you with me? I might have lost him because I know his phone was going in and out. Well, I'm sorry. Oh no, there you are. I'm sorry. It was your mic had gotten you. Yes. Did you hear my question? Were you able to hear my question?
Yeah. And what I was going to say was that one of the things that Trump said was when a police officer was handling a prisoner, that he should make sure that he bumps his head against the squad car.
Right.
So that sends out a signal right there that it's okay to hurt and abuse people. And this is coming from the President of the United States. But
exactly.
I think that really what's happening is that, you know, the police department and the military is inundated with white supremacists.
Yes, they are.
I mean, you can see it by the things that they do and the things that they do in black communities. They are occupying forces. They don't want to live in the black community. They want to come to the black community, terrorize the people, and then go back to the suburbs or the rural areas where they live.
Right. Okay. I agree. I think you're right. And I think that there are some kind of movements that have probably come together to support any police officer who may be caught up in a situation like that. And they lose their job or their pay, and there's some kind of support. And I'm sure that there are people that are wealthy enough to be able to do that. Which then gets to my point, is that they don't care at that point. I'll lose my job. In my fact, that's good, because I can take me a break, get paid, and do what I have to do. So it's almost like an encouragement to do that, which is why we're going to keep on seeing those killings. So until they attack things like that, they have to... You have to hit them in the pocket, and I don't think that they are being hit in their pocket, you know, because they really don't care.
I think you're absolutely right about that, because you see the police getting away with killing people under circumstances which regular citizens would be going to jail for.
Right.
So police officers already know that, you know, if I kill somebody, I'm going to be all right. I'm going to get away with this. I'm going to be off with pay while they conduct a sham investigation, and then I'm going to be right back at work.
Okay.
So, I mean, until they start locking these guys up, it's going to continue.
Okay. I agree. Okay. Let's take a quick break at the top of the hour, and we're going to come back, and I want to see what some of our audience feels, our listening audience that's online now, that's on the phone. See what you think about this. What did you see? Is this something deeper? And that's really what I'd like to find. I'd like to find if there's another deeper, sinister motive behind all of this. And I really do think that could very well be the case. So we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
What hurt us most was when we bought into the socialization process. Let me tell you what that is. Socialization is where you get your ideas, your principles, and your concepts on how to live your life. Okay? What we call integration was white people, so-called white people, primarily Jewish people, who sold us a perspective on life called integration. See, it wasn't just that word. It was perspective on life called integration that said, partner with us white folks and you're going to be all right. Hadn't been in a hostile relationship with white folks so long and had suffered at the end of it, we were looking for relief, so we were willing to partner thinking we were creating a new humanity. But what happened, we were disarmed in the war. We were disarmed. And so the same people who were asking us to do this was the primary retailers in all black communities across America. The same people who were asking us to do this was the ones who was running the school boards and the schools in our community. The same people who were asking us to do this were the very people who was controlling the music industry. The same people who were asking us to do this was the very people who was controlling the movie industry as it affects us. So these same people were the ones who were the managers of the sports and athletes from the black community. So they're telling us, don't compete with us, integrate with us, but we're running everything. So they're making billions off of us, and we're not making nothing. And what we're saying now, we need to wake up to the reality that it's about ethnicity. Okay? You must do for self, as Elijah Muhammad told us. You know, Malcolm said, black nationalism, people say, oh, I don't want to be that. Define black nationalism, Mr. Malcolm X. He said, black nationalism is owning the economics, politics, and culture where you live, being in control of economic politics and culture where you live. That sounds like Chinatown to me. That sounds like Williamsburg, Brooklyn to me.
Right, right.
That sounds like Little Italy to me. So why can't be Little Black or Little Africa? You know what I'm saying? If we got to compete with some people in an economic process, we can't play by rules that's different from the rules that make the game. You can't go on a basketball court with a football in your hand and think you're going to run the 100-yard dash. That ain't going to work. You're going to lose at that basketball game every time. So you got to find out what the rules of the economic game is, and then you have to learn how to play it better than the person that's in the game with you. And what we're learning about economics, at the end of the day, the motivation for economics is the need to provide food, clothing, shelter, safety, and security for ourselves and our family. See, we can talk all this other stuff. Well, I got a degree because I want to go to college. I want to be a doctor. I want to be a lawyer. Why? You want to make money. Why do you want to make money? Because I've got to buy some food. I got to buy some clothing, I got to afford some shelter, and I want to provide safety for my family. So that's the bottom line. And if that is the bottom line, you got to be in control of that. You can't depend on someone else to deliver that to you. And so what Happy is going to try to show is how to develop black businesses, how to manage black businesses, how to organize black people around the management and the marketing of black economic enterprises where we live, especially in the United States of America, but anywhere in the world we happen to be today, where we control the retail and the wholesale that affects us. If you see the little Arabs in our community, You see, all Arabs are working in the stores. The guy that comes with that little box truck to deliver the produce to the stores, they're all Arabs. The little warehouse that the box truck picked up from, which is now at the wholesale end of that retail chain, they're all Arabs. That's the way you do it. The problem with that picture is the consumer that's giving all those Arab guys work so they can make money and go home and take care of their families are all black folks. You see? And at the same time, we're giving all those consumer dollars to this community. Our young men and women are standing on the street because there's no store for them to go and get a job in. There's no retail business in the community that they can work in that they own, because other ethnic groups are hiring their own people so that they can provide the food, clothing, shelter, safety, and security for themselves. I'm not anti-anybody. We're not anti-anybody. We just pro-black folks being to feed, clothe, and shelter themselves. And you cannot do this if you're so naive and you're so ignorant, you give the best of your capital away to someone else who's trying to do the same thing for themselves.
Here's your time for an awakening media lineup. Monday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., African Perspectives, with host Brother Oshi, Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Same time, same place. Continued Monday lineup, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., Acres of Diamonds, with host Brother Jihad Ahmed, 8 p.m. to 9 p.m., Black Therapy Central, host Dr. Mawia Kambom and Sister Nataki Kambom, 9 p.m. till 10 p.m., Conversation Reparations, first and third Mondays. On Tuesday, 8 p.m. till 10 p.m., Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers. On Thursday, 7 p.m. till 9 p.m., Melanin Live with host Lance Jones, co-host Boniswa Ayan. Fridays, 8 p.m. to 10 p.m., Time for an Awakening with creator of Time for an Awakening and host Brother Elliot, co-hosted by Brother Richard. Saturday, 4 p.m. till 6 p.m., Black Sister Talk with host Wanda Chambers. 7 p.m. till 9 p.m., The Elders of Sankofa. And Sunday, 7 p.m. till 9 p.m., Time for an Awakening, host Brother Elliot and co-host Brother Richard. Check us out.
Listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Good afternoon, good evening, my brothers and sisters. This is William Rogers, your host. We are back from our station break. We thank you so much for being here with us tonight. We are talking about the psychosis that we have been watching over the last week or so, trying to get an understanding of it from an African perspective. And I think one of the key points that Brother Smalls brought out in the clip that we played, we're not against anything. We're not against anybody. We've got to be for black folk. And I think the bottom line to all of this and the understanding of all of this is we've got to build ourselves in our own community. We have to have an economic and a political agenda. And that has to be put in motion by us. We have to do that. Nobody else can do that for us. And I think that's the whole purpose. The Black Reality Think Tank is a think tank. We are here to pull together, to think about things, raise questions. We don't have answers for everything. Well, that's not what we're trying to do. But we're just simply trying to bring us all together. Let's talk about it, see what we can do, how we can build, where we can go from here, and just make it happen for our children. Our children are coming behind, and I say, like I said, my grandson, my five-year-old grandson, Grandpa, what's wrong with them people? And they were climbing those walls. He said, what's wrong with them? His sister, who's a little bit older, she said, that looked like World War Z with those zombies. I said, yeah, well, they are zombies. And they just kind of laughed. But they're looking for some directions from us to help them and to guide them in terms of what they need to do and prepare for and become serious about life. And so that's what we're doing here tonight. We're not here to attack anything or anybody. There is a body of knowledge and a body of science that tells us what this is. It tells us what it's designed to try to do and to keep us from being able to do. So we have to decipher that, analyze, deal with it, and then move on it right away. And that's what we're here for tonight. So I think I was just talking with my dear brother, the police officer, who was here to kind of give some understanding of that in connection with what we saw. Because, like I said, this is going to be over a little while, in a couple of weeks, a couple of months maybe from now, Biden comes into office, all this is going to be over. He can bring out the militia and the National Guard and take care of all this. And we're going to go back to shooting black people and starving and evictions and all kind of things that we're getting ready to go through now. And the COVID still keeps pushing. One of the things I was wondering about, with all them white folks out there, what happened with the COVID deal? Why, and I think I am hearing some folk did get it. What happened? You didn't hear anything about COVID. You just kept hearing about them fighting. I'm sure that there has to be some repercussion from some of that. So anyway, let me open up the lines, and I want to hear from some of our guests, our panelists, those of you who have been our supporters over these years. I appreciate you so much. Maybe come on and talk a little bit about what you see, what you saw. What do you think? Like I said, this is a think tank. This is what we want to think this thing out. What ideas can you bring us? So let me go to my good brother, Herbie White, from Durham, North Carolina. How you doing, brother Herbie?
Good evening, Dr. Rogers. How you doing?
Doing great, great. How you doing?
I'm doing fine.
What did you see last week?
What we have to consider is that the election of Barack Obama was a traumatic event for the theory of white supremacy.
Mm-hmm.
So they were losing their grip. So when Donald Trump was elected and he said, I'm going to make America great again, what he was telling white people is, I'm going to make being white the most valuable thing in America.
Right.
Not wealth, not intelligence, just being white will make you valuable. So this resonated with all the poor, ignorant, helpless white people.
Right.
This is something that they could grab onto, because during in Durham, back in the days, the bus station was segregated.
Right.
The people on the bus, white person could be the poorest person on that bus, but he got a chance to go into that other side of that bus station just by him being white.
By being white, that's right.
His whiteness was his value. And so Donald Trump went on to exhibit that by doing whatever he wanted to do, and nobody could do nothing about it.
That's right.
So when he lost the election, that triggered a manic event with these people. Everything evaporated. And they could not endure it. They could not accept that.
Good point. Good point. Good point.
In the 40s or 50s, when the poorest white person in Durham could walk up to C.C. Spoiler, Merrick Moore, and slap the hell out of him, and nothing would happen to him.
Right.
Just because they were white.
Just because they were white. That's the psychosis. That's it.
That's the psychosis. Just by being white, it makes me special. Now you take that away from them, they got nothing.
Right.
So the fact that all of that was evaporated from them right there when Trump was lost the election, they couldn't deal with it.
Yeah. It's true. It's true. I agree with you. Thank you, Brother White. Thank you so much. Brother Timothy, what you think?
I'm going to come behind Brother White and say, not only did Donald Trump lose, he had to tell them, especially with a woman at the high point of the ticket, is going to be running with a white man. The other thing is, you mean to tell me you're going to let her in? I'd rather say they cheated than to say they won. And when he won the challenge, the electorate. But how many recounts did he have, Dr. Rogers?
Yeah.
In the listening audience? Oh, my God, they didn't stop recounting. Then the other situation that went down with it. The whole time this is going on, Dr. Rogers, he's trying to tear the country apart. He finds the people like himself that are out there to help him. And you know what? When they rally, it didn't hardly faze him once not to say, it's okay, go down there and show them how to fight. They wouldn't ramshack their own buildings.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Unbelievable. I mean, you know, and the more you see how equipped these people are. Ex-military people.
That's right.
Ex-cops. I mean, stuff that they got that I didn't even wow. You know what I mean?
Right.
And they went down there to create harm.
At pipe bombs.
Men
guns.
With women.
Yeah.
Oh, God. The more you see it, the more it make you sick. Then the other thing is, if you talk to some Republicans, or the Republicans say, he should just step off and resign. Are you serious?
Mm-hmm.
You mean to tell me he went against a government that got him elected? He got angry because he didn't get elected the second time. Y'all want him to walk.
Right.
Now, y'all out of y'all mind now. He got to pay.
Yep.
Some type of justice, whether it's in the street or it's in jail. And that's the truth. You can't have nobody do that. They can't, they don't want to do it to each other that they do. They'd rather do it to us. You know what, Mr. Rogers? If it was black people that went to the White House like that, we would have made it, never made it to the steps.
They wouldn't have lived to see the sunrise the next day.
And other thing, Dr. Rogers, they tell me they knew about this 2 months ago.
Yeah. So why do you think that they... do you think that there's some other motive behind this? What is it that they wanted to prove? What is it that... Okay, so you go to the White House, you tear it up, you take guns and pipe bombs and do it for what? What's the message?
The message is that always remember, you and I are still black.
Okay.
Sister Benicia were behind the walls and all. Listen to me, man. Few people sprout up and get a few positions. You and I say, okay. They look like, oh, no, no.
Yeah. Okay.
How many of them gonna come now? What else they gonna take? What else they gonna do?
So it's like what Brother Herbert said.
We're flooded with drugs and everything else. We don't, we're not giving no education.
Right.
They wonder how we're making it.
Yeah.
That's just my spin personally. I don't know. I could be wrong, but I could be right too.
I like what you said. I like what you said. And I hope you're taking care of that cold. You got a little cold there, it sounds like, huh?
Yeah, you're right, man. I can't help it. So much going on with you and the team.
Take care of that. Okay. Let me go back to my brother, police officer. Let me ask you, one of the things that I was thinking about, okay, so why would they give out, now in other words, those that came to the White House had to have a permit, correct? When you assemble like that, you have to go get a permit. Am I correct, my brother?
Yes, you are correct.
Okay, so why would they issue a permit for thousands of people in the midst of a COVID-19 situation when you got all these restrictions about people gathering in large numbers?
Well, another thing we have to remember is that Trump has downplayed the COVID virus.
Yeah, that's correct.
And as a result, hundreds of thousands of people have died, but a lot of people follow his lead and believe that COVID is not a threat.
Right.
I mean, they were even saying that during the siege, there were members of the Republican Senate that refused to wear masks, and now some of the Democrats have caught COVID, and they're mad at them about that.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, these people blindly follow that man.
Okay. Now, you know, Washington, D.C. Is designed, you know, the pattern, the street pattern and the layout and design is based around security and safety. Have you heard that? Have you ever heard that?
Well, I know that the White House is, and that's another thing. That's why I was saying earlier that I think this goes all the way to the top, because the FBI had intel that this was going to happen before it happened. And while it was happening, I think it was the mayor that tried to call in the National Guard, and they refused to deploy the National Guard. So, you know, having intel that this is going to happen, there should have already been increased security in place.
Right.
So that tells me that they were complicit in this.
Yes.
In spite of what they would want us to believe, there's no way in the world that they should have left that place unsecure like that after getting information that there was going to be a large protest or a siege.
Right. Exactly. That's the thing that definitely puzzles me. I mean, the normal understanding is you can't get within a mile or 2 miles of the White House. You know, if you get anywhere near a certain area, there's all kind of stuff comes at you. When those
I was just going to say, if you recall, and one of my brothers reminded me today that, if you recall, I think it was back in 2013, there was a black woman in a car.
Yeah, right.
That attempted to drive through a fence, and she was chased down and shot and killed by the Capitol Police.
That's
now,
amazing.
How could that happen? But then you have hundreds or thousands of people attacking the White House, and only one shot was fired. I mean, just think about it. You can't put nothing past these people. Think about it.
You're right. No doubt about that. Brother Lush, what do you think? What do you think happened last week?
I think that everybody had a version of some sort of the Turner Diaries. Are you familiar with the Turner Diaries?
Oh yeah. That's what Timothy McVeigh used.
I think everybody dust off their books, man,
right,
and started reading.
Yes,
you
right.
Understand?
That's exactly right.
And let me just say, Doc Rogers, once again, I've said it to you in the email, and I'm saying it to you personally. Thank you for this program.
Thank you.
It gets to be somewhat therapeutic for me at times. And what I want to interject here is, when do we learn how to fight?
I was thinking about that.
I said that before, and you know, folks kind of, what is he talking about? When do we learn how to fight back? Now, even though it wasn't directed to us particularly
right
now, but if that is happening, then what's going to happen next?
That's right.
And so these programs, Dr. Rogers, these programs that's on the Black Reality Think Tank and the Black Talk Radio Network and all others, of which there are many, I think of as being the drums of the tribes in the old country. These drums started beating and they had meaning. And these drums, we had to sit down and patiently listen to the message that's being sent. And so this is what I'm expressing on this evening. And thank you for allowing me this time. Because of the fact that we can take those books that you've mentioned.
Right.
And we could crack them open. And we could read from cover to cover the opinions and perspectives of the various representative authors. But at what time do, especially if it's a hardback book, something as thick as The Crisis of the Negro Intellectual,
right,
and close that book and swing it like you've never swung it before? And this is what I'm saying. You know, we've gone to school. We've done what we were supposed to do, Doc Rogers. But at what point do we learn how to fight? And the reason why I'm saying that is maybe the window of opportunity for us to fight is closed. Right? And no disrespect to the Christian religion and various gods and goddesses and Africans. Look, they never showed themselves. Jesus never showed himself.
Right.
In the midst of the madness, to try to just say, silence, just peace be still, and everybody froze. It didn't happen. And so, either we're going to learn eventually how to come to fight or get trampled over.
Exactly.
And not just physically, intellectually, spiritually, morally, etc., etc. Thank you so very much, as always.
That's
Dr.
Great.
Rogers,
that's
for
good.
Taking my call.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. And you're right. When we look back at the times that we have struck back, a lot of it was betrayal, Denmark, Versailles, Gabriel Prosser. They were all turned in by their brothers. The Stonewall Rebellion was a little bit more. Nat Turner's rebellion was a little stronger. He was able to make some headway and results there. John Brown, that rebellion was there. But we haven't stood up. And when we, in a way that we can be effective and get results out of that. And be able to walk away. And I know it goes back to that white psychosis. It goes back to what my brother said about a police officer with a gun and a badge and whiteness too. Or he feels he's God. Nobody can stop him. And so, you know, right, we've got to come somewhere. We've got to find the medium, because the way it has been done before, it's without order. It has not been with plan in a way that it needs to be planned to do. But we've got to stand up. We can't let our people keep shooting our kids. Like you said, man, you're shooting our children in the streets, and we putting up teddy bears. Come on, y'all. You know, we got to move in. Like the last poet said, how many more bullets is it going to be? Brother Pugh, haven't seen you in a while. Hope you're doing okay. I got your email you sent me, and I'm going to respond to that. How you doing? What's your thoughts on all this?
Pretty good, doctor. Well, I would say it's Trump. That's my explanation for it. His personality is such that he doesn't have any kind of constraints, any kind of limits.
Right.
Now, your psychosis model, that's just church. In other words, you can say anything to anybody and get them to, you know, operate in some kind of alternative reality.
Mm-hmm.
And so what he's basically done, so let me just summarize this. I think that what's going on is that he wanted to punish Nancy Pelosi. And you know, your earlier guest talked about Michael Flynn and his advice to Trump to declare an insurrection and then, you know, declare a, you know, a kind of state of emergency.
Right, right.
And so, that kind of stuff is going on. But I would say this, that the news today, I just heard someone say that 20 Republican senators are moving against Trump. McConnell has already said he's against Trump. Christie said that if this is not impeachable, then nothing is. Lynn Cheney in the House, the number three Republican in the House, mm-hmm. Said that she will vote for impeachment. And so what it appears to be is that the fever is breaking and that Trump, he may very well even be removed. Not only just impeached, but he may very well be convicted. But the challenge that we have is that right now the formulation that people have is they're telling the Republicans that you can either vote for your country or you can vote for Trump. When I think the real formulation should be you should either vote for democracy or you should vote for white supremacy, because it turns out that the engine that Trump used to, you know, kind of get these people climbing the walls and stuff fired up was this concept of white supremacy. And then I'm going to end with this. By the way, you saw when Barack Obama was elected in 2008,
right,
that these white people were prepared to submit to the authority of a black man. In other words, most white people were prepared to submit to that authority.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the same way in North Carolina, in Wilmington, where you had these fusion coalition of blacks, Republicans, and white farmers who were operating economically. Blacks were very prosperous and whatnot. And the white plantation types decided that they were going to draw a wedge between the white farmers and the black people so as to end that government and take over. So what I'm saying is that that's the same thing that Trump did,
right?
When he saw how Barack really misplayed his hand, and basically the country gave him the keys to the country. And because Barack was scared to actually take the power and use it,
yeah, he was.
Mm-hmm. Trump saw that there was an opening, and so he essentially came in and brought that and used that to drive a wedge between blacks and whites. So in any case,
that's a good point. That's a very good point. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. Thank you, Sister Benicia. Are you going to be ready on the 20th? They said they're going to attack all the states, and they're coming after everybody. You gonna be ready?
I'm just gonna have my popcorn and watch this stuff on TV.
Mm-hmm. Hey, what did Gil Scott Heron tell you? Ain't gonna be televised.
I mean, yes, it is, because everybody's got a camera, and it's all over the news. And so, this is what I've got to say. First, greetings to my brothers and sisters. I love you all.
Thank you.
We need some black love, plenty of it. I want to say that this thing, the things that happen in America, because it is a sociopathic system full of psychopathic white men and women, I don't think anything is by chance. I think almost, you know, things that happen like this, mm-hmm. I think they're well planned out. And at this point, it is being reported that this is what happened with the white insurrection was absolutely an inside job.
Right.
So now that some white folk were threatened, now they want to do something about it.
Right.
But I want to say to black folk, you know, with all the protesting and all the voting that we were told to do and all the peaceful this and all the peaceful that, you get no damn where. Nowhere. No results. But when white folk get mad and they climb up the walls of the Capitol and whatnot, they get right in. And now they're getting results. And they got to do this with Trump, and they got to do this, you know, and they're getting busy.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm saying?
Right.
So,
exactly.
You know, unfortunately, we can't fight this monster, because this monster has been genociding us out ever since we've been here, genociding out the Australians, well, the Aboriginals in Australia, genociding out the Africans on the motherland. I just heard that the black Brazilians, they're mm-hmm. being killed off so in such large numbers
oh, yeah.
that they're
yeah.
realizing that they have to unify now.
Right. Right.
And this is what, 2021?
Yes,
they're beginning to realize that they're black and that they have to unify, because this white psychosis that you're talking about
mm-hmm.
is, it runs throughout the white race. Not, thankfully, not everyone, but it's huge enough that it is impacting and genociding out Africans all over the globe. So,
right.
But yeah, it's definitely an inside job.
Okay.
The way they just open the gates for these, you know, lunatics to come in and do whatever they wanted to. It was just so obvious. You know, that's why I'm just going to sit back. And I think that the best thing that black folk can do, because that's who I'm concerned about, I'm not concerned about this country.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not concerned about white folk and nobody else. I'm concerned about my people first. And then the others can, I'll have some concern for. But it's us first. So, you know, I like what the brother was saying, Brother Lush. And he talked about, at what point are we going to learn how to fight? We better get prepared. And I've said this many times, because when white folk get angry, like the ones that, you know, ran into the Capitol building and whatnot, you know who they scapegoat?
Mm-hmm. You're dead.
Us.
Us. Yep.
They scapegoat us. In the early 1900s, every time black people build businesses and towns and became doctors and lawyers and teachers, we were, well, whites found some kind of way to kill, in their words, kill the niggers.
Right.
They had to go nigger hunting.
Right. Destroy right. what you've gained.
Their motto is, we have to stay in our place. They don't even have that motto for Muslims or LGBT and all the other so-called other groups. But for black folks, when it looks like we're getting out of our place, that's when they get their violence just rises. So this is a time for us, I'm really saying this, y'all, for us to, you know, get prepared, get armed, do whatever we have to do, because these nuts might go crazy for a very long time, and we don't need to be sitting ducks.
I agree. Thank you. Thank you so much. Sister Dee Dee, you always say I miss you, and I don't let you get you. You want to add to this conversation, or just listen?
Thank you so much, Dr. Rogers. But you know what? Everyone done stole my thunder, and it was so good, and it was really good hearing from the sister. I miss hearing from her. And good evening, all my wonderful black brothers and sisters out there.
Right.
And Brother Lush, I love hearing you also, man. Y'all something else. But Dr. Rogers, they said a mouthful. All this is staged, and Dr. Rogers, you know my favorite saying, it's all by design.
Right.
And thank you so much for mentioning my Dr. Khaled Muhammad. Thank you for that.
No doubt about it.
Today's his birthday.
No doubt about it. That's right. This was his birthday, right? Today is his birthday.
Yes, today is his birthday.
Yesterday, okay. All right. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Yes, thank you.
All right. My brother out of Detroit.
313-400. Greetings, Dr. Rogers.
Greetings, my brother. How you doing?
Yeah, I'm really enjoying the show tonight. I'm glad to hear this from a black perspective.
Yes.
So we've been listening to the Caucasians, but they give theirs. We like to give ours. But I, too, am of the mind that this was orchestrated from the top.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Trump, on down, orchestrated this, and those Caucasians, those Neanderthals that were there, were actually used as pawns.
Mm-hmm.
They fired them up, had them go down there and do all of this damage at the Capitol. And I think a few of them were in the know about, you know, who to try to grab and what to do. But most of them were just like mindless
mindless. Fat. Right.
They were mindless, and they were just there, just that they were just there to tear up, destroy, kill, steal and destroy, like they said.
Mm-hmm.
And that is my take.
Okay.
They were used. They were used.
Great.
And now we do. We have to prepare ourselves.
We have
and,
to.
And do not get in the mix with any of them. There
That's
was actually
right.
a few black people that were there, and they were attacked.
Right.
Huh.
So when they go down there, we just stay away. And as our sister Bonice was saying, let's watch it on TV.
Yeah. That's right.
Okay. Brother Marcus, how you doing tonight, Brother Marcus?
I'm doing all right, good brother.
All right. How you want to grab, how you want to deal with your white brothers?
Well, you take your stimulus check, buy a gun, and a whole lot of ammunition. Because, you know, you need ammunition, you know, to deal with these people. But January 17th is another pivotal date.
Mm-hmm.
Because these people are planning to march on all the state's capital, all 50 state capitals.
Mm-hmm.
And this time they're going there with their guns. Okay? They're not going in there blind this time. So that's another pivotal date, because if something jumps off, they can't look to get no help from the federal government, because Trump will still be there.
Mm-hmm.
So it ain't over. It's not over. So I agree with all the callers tonight. We got to get prepared, because we see what these people doing.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I got to say, good brother. Thank you.
Thank you, Brother Marcus. And you're right. I mean, and you've seen over the last couple of months some of the stuff that they were preparing to do, like kidnapping the governor of Michigan and going up into Wisconsin and doing some of the crap that they were going to do up there. It's just this is levels of behavior that we haven't seen before. You know, we've always had those assassins, people that, you know, such as these police officers, but this level of behavior, we just haven't seen this before. Brother Griffin, is that you, 757-218? Newport.
Yes,
New-
sir, Dr. Rod.
Yes, sir.
How you doing?
All right. Would you want to add something to this?
No. Only thing I'll say is that people keep talking about this started from the top, but there's a good article I'm going to post it on your Facebook page out of the Atlantic. These people weren't low-life people. When you look at what's going on in America, a lot of the people that did what they did,
right,
are actually business owners, what we would call middle class.
Huh?
So some of y'all calling in talking about just the bigotry part of it, are kind of missing it. These people are celebrating what Mitch McConnell has been doing for the last 7, 8, 10 years, stacking the court and all of this. They're celebrating success. I don't think you ought to just put them down for just being rabid, insane white folks. The people at the top manipulated these people out to this celebration.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's right. That's exactly right. Do you think, Brother Griffin, that there's a bigger, sinister plot behind all of this? Because even with some of the things we said, and everybody just made some profound statements, there's still something just don't sound right. You know, just too many, like we said, too many things that could have stopped us. You know, and I know that like you said, there's going to be, it might be a higher power somewhere. But, you know, this country operates on an international platform. You got corporations that earn $10 trillion. You got people, they can't have this. They wouldn't be able to.
But, yeah. Dr. Rogers, I want to ask you, when you listen to people like Dr. Wilma Leon and Juma Baraka, they see it from a little bit different point of view. So we all kind of come together looking at a train wreck from a different angle.
Right. That's
what I'm saying to you, you say that there's no benefit. Well, how do they benefit? This country benefits from keeping people completely divided, definitely across race, but even the class issue now, and this is what I'm saying to you. They're making it sound like some just rednecks ran up there and did what they did.
Right.
I'm telling you, this is like 6,000 to 8,000 people. Now, you stop to think about this. That spent their money basically on the spur of the moment, coming from all across this nation, because mm-hmm. they had a right to be white and do what they're going to do in their country. But it goes further than just those people that came here from everyday people. I'm telling you, the Mitch McConnells did the same thing and said basically a middle finger to black folks and the rest, and any poor, the poor white folks that don't understand that all they got is whiteness. They're suffering too. I'll give you an idea. They said when you look at the metadata on the people that won in I believe, Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, I believe. No, I'm not taking that back. Pennsylvania and Ohio is the exact quote. Every county that Trump flipped, guess what it ended up being? A poor white opiate county that got hit by hard by the opiate. Now watch this. So that means, yeah, the poor white people did it. But this is what I'm telling you. They ain't the people that showed up at the Capitol. Mm-hmm. The people that showed up at the Capitol is their cousins that could afford to travel on their own and take action on that aid.
Right.
That's mm-hmm. my point.
Okay.
This goes to when people, when you hear intelligent people that have been to Yale and Harvard that have been elected to Congress, and they stand up telling you why the president is not culpable in what he did, Pookie and Ronnie and Jesus, all they got to do is be associated with somebody in the gang, and they locked him up just like they did in New York City and Detroit.
Right.
Just for being connected on... Why you let a man come out here and tell you, I'm going to meet you at the Capitol, and he ain't liable for it? Yeah, there's a whole lot involved in this, and I tell you what, it makes COINTELPRO look like child's play, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. Okay. All right. That's that. And I think those are the things that we got to look at. And we got to look at them in that way.
Dr. Rogers.
Yes. Uh-huh.
May I? Or
yeah.
Are you?
Yeah, no, go right ahead. Go right ahead.
You're talking about looking deeper into this situation. That's what I've been doing. And I'm remembering far back, you know. And I'm remembering one election, I don't know, it was 8 years ago, 12 years ago, when one of those cats from Texas was running for Republican nominee for president. And he kept talking about secession if they don't get their way. Mm-hmm. You know, Texas seceding from the U.S. And after Barack Obama was elected, white neo-Nazi hate groups increased 200%, not just in America, but also in Germany and other parts of Europe. There's also been talk and preparation of having a civil war for several years.
That's so exactly right. That's exactly right.
Yeah, that civil war, race war, this could be a sign of things to come. And that's why I was saying we have to be prepared.
I like that.
Yeah, we have to be knowledgeable, but look at where this is going, because when these people rise up in violence and they're so bloodthirsty, they don't mm-hmm. ever get enough.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this bears repeating. Black people usually are always the first scapegoat.
Mm-hmm.
They get mad, they look around, they look for a black person to shoot.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Because they're not going to Seattle, Washington, or Portland and shoot Apple and seize Apple.
Right.
They're not going to go up against Grumman. They have their own military forces.
That's right.
They have their own police force. Their own military.
They sure do.
You're not going to bother them.
They have their own bunkers. They're preparing, and we are not.
Right.
They are prepared, and a lot of them were military.
Yes.
Look at that woman that was shot. She was military.
Yeah, that's right.
Look how exactly what we're
taking pictures with them.
What'd you say, sister? I didn't mean to interrupt.
The police were taking pictures with them, passing them out water, even went as far as open the barricades and stuff for them.
fact.
And this is the pattern. This is the pattern that you know, the point I want to get across. Let's look at the pattern, y'all. You know, there's all kinds of things that's been happening. There was, I think during that same election I was talking about with whoever said they want, you know, were talking about secession. Remember when every Republican had to go and kiss Donald Trump's ring? Anybody remember that? When he was on Trump Towers, he wasn't running for president. Somebody else was. But everybody had to go, because I remember Mitt Romney had to go and kiss the ring of Donald Trump. And I was saying, what's this about? This goes back at least 8 years, 12 years, actually.
No, it was when Trump was elected president.
It was before that. It was before that.
No,
he wasn't running.
Mitt Romney wanted to be Secretary of State, and that's why he had that dinner with Trump.
Mm-hmm. This was another situation where everybody who was running for presidential for the presidency, they had to go to Trump Tower and meet with Trump, and he was nowhere in politics. And I kept saying, "This is strange. What does he have to do with anything?" So, in other words, there's stuff going on that we don't know about.
Exactly, and that's what I'm talking about.
Pay attention and protect ourselves.
That's right. Because you still got the underworld that's operating every day, and you know they're born killers, and that's not going to.
You better know it.
I'd like to make one sentence about complicity. Did y'all hear Jim Clyburn, who said that? He said he has an office that has his name on it as a majority whip. And it's easy to access, but he's never in that office. That the actual office that he works in is really hard to find, and he doesn't have his name on the door.
Mm-hmm.
He said that nobody tried to break into the office with his name on the door, but they instead came to his real office. And they said he said the only way that could have happened is that somebody had to tell them where I was.
And like you said, higher up. We got about two or three minutes. I'm going to ask 414-573. You want to say anything?
Thanks, Doc. I'm just listening to the comments. I know we've been saying for a long time we got to prepare ourselves. But you know, we don't see eye to eye even in our neighborhood, our communities. So, you know, I'm just saying, like, how are we going to all pull this together? Because, and you know, be on one accord, because we got so many different feelings. We got a lot of Trump supporters.
Mm-hmm.
We got, you know, in our communities and stuff. So, you know, when are we going to do something?
Right.
And then are we going to do anything? So that's just my question.
Okay.
But thank you.
Well, folks, as usual, it has come to the hour, closing time. I thank you all so much, so very much, for your comments and your thoughts and your thing. This is a think tank. That's what we're here for. How can we move our community forward? That's the bottom line. And how do we do it in a way that is safe for all, for us, meaning when I say for all, for us? How do we continue to build on the economic agenda that we must continue to build on, as Dr. Small said in the clip that we played. So those are things that we have to think about. We'll be back next week. We've got a very exciting show coming on Saturday. They're going to talk about, four doctors are going to talk about the vaccine and what's in it and so forth. That's on the Elders Council. That's the Elders program on Saturday at 6. So you might want to listen to that. But anyway, we appreciate you, and we will see you next Tuesday, same time. Have a wonderful, wonderful week.
And he pretends.